Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Friday, the 8th of November, these are our main stories. President Trump has been ordered to repay $2 million of charity funds he used on his 2016 presidential campaign. South Sudan's rival leaders have agreed to postpone the formation of a power-sharing government against the wishes of the United Nations. And a body discovered under a dance floor in western Russia has been identified as that of a French general said to have been Napoleon's favorite. Also in this podcast,
to think that sparkles are frivolous diminishes what I would consider to be a higher authority.
A sparkling geek on stage, how one scientist is using fashion to subvert traditional ideas about her industry. But we begin this podcast in the United States, where President Donald Trump has been ordered to pay $2 million to resolve a lawsuit which alleges that charity money from the Donald J. Trump Foundation was illegally used to fund his election campaign. The lawsuit was filed by the New York State Attorney General's office, and it also implicated President Trump's three eldest children, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. Our correspondent in New York, Neda Tofik, told me more about the lawsuit.
Well, this is certainly extremely embarrassing. I mean, keep in mind, at the moment, he's about to face public hearings in Washington on an impeachment and charges that he abused power and tried to pressure Ukraine to investigate his political rival. So here in this case, you have that he broke New York charity laws in order to further his political ambition. So this looks really bad for the president, particularly at this time. But really, this has been a years-long saga. His foundation really came under scrutiny when he ran for president, and he tried to shut it down in December of 2016, saying that he wanted to kind of get rid of any conflicts of interest. But New York State went ahead and said, we're going to investigate your foundation, and in June of 2018 launched a lawsuit. Now, all of this was part of a big settlement, and today's announcement really kind of ties the bow on that settlement with New York State, where they have finally gotten the kind of the last few details sorted. So in the past, he had then did, in fact, dissolve his foundation. Now he's paying more than $2 million in damages. And another major part of this is that he had to, as part of this settlement, admit personally that he did misuse illegally the foundation's funds to further his political interests in the 2016 presidential election.
This all comes amid the impeachment inquiry in Washington into Mr. Trump. Will this have an impact on that process?
You know, I don't think it necessarily will. Certainly people are saying, will this civil case lead to possible criminal charges in New York State? Also, we know that the New York Attorney General has referred this matter over to the Federal Elections Commission, the IRS. We're unsure what may come of that. But I think certainly when you consider this case, it is very, very separate from the impeachment hearings going on in Washington, D.C. I think what people will look at, though, is what this says about the president and how he operates, and certainly what the attorney general has said here in New York is that she believes that the president, you know, wanted to get away with this, and she's saying this shows that nobody can get away with breaking the law.
Neda Tofik. To Italy next, where an 89-year-old Jewish Holocaust survivor has been assigned police protection after receiving hundreds of threats from far-right supporters. Last month, Liliana Segre, who is a senator for life in Italy, called for Parliament to establish a committee to investigate hatred and prejudice. Laura Boldrini is the former president of the lower house of the Italian Parliament and a current member of Parliament for the centre-left Democratic Party. She's been giving her reaction to Tim Franks.
Well, when I heard that news, I actually felt very sad for Liliana, because Liliana Segre is an 8-9 years old lady. She's a prominent figure in Italy. She's a senator for life who survived a concentration camp in Poland, in Auschwitz. So she's a survivor of Holocaust. And now she has to accept the protection of the police in order to feel safe. So this is absolutely unacceptable. She deserves much more than this.
And am I right in saying that the threats against her increased after last month she successfully proposed this parliamentary commission to investigate hatred, racism and anti-Semitism?
Well, actually, I think even before, the situation was quite critical. I know Liliana very well. She's a friend. And this started years ago, because the situation in this country, Italy, you know, is becoming very polarized. So those who are exposed on human rights, on civil liberties, are very much targeted. And of course, with the bill which passed in the Senate, she was even more exposed. And since three parties, right parties, decided not to vote in favor of such a committee, of course, she was even more considered like, you know, somebody to attack, especially in the social media. Racism is becoming a problem. Anti-Semitism is becoming a problem. And also misogyny is becoming a serious problem.
Laura Boldrini. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey is once again using his country's gateway border to Europe as a bargaining chip, saying he'll permit mass migration of refugees unless the EU provides additional support to accommodate migrants in Turkey. Mr. Erdogan was speaking during a visit to Hungary. Reporting from Budapest, Nick Thorpe.
The Turkish president threatened to open the gates, as he put it, to allow 4 million asylum seekers now in Turkey to continue their journey to Europe. The threat is not new, but had symbolic significance, pronounced alongside a European Union Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, who's built his political career on opposing what he calls illegal migrants to Europe. Alone in the EU, Mr. Orban has also supported the ongoing Turkish invasion of northern Syria.
Nick Thorpe. Now to a story that's been dominating conversations online. The American rapper, actor and TV host T.I. sparked a huge backlash after he revealed he accompanies his 18-year-old daughter, Daya Harris, to a gynecological exam each year for her hymen and virginity to be checked. It's a practice condemned as humiliating and traumatic by the World Health Organization. The comments originally aired in a podcast. Our reporter Farhana Dawood has been following the story.
The comments have garnered so much outrage that the podcast itself, that episode, is now no longer available. Basically, what the rapper said is that every year since his daughter was 16, he takes her annually to have her hymen checked, just after her birthday, in fact. He was discussing sex education and his children when he made these comments. He said he takes his daughter to a doctor and he gets her to sign a waiver of her confidentiality so the examination and the results can be given to him. Now, as I said, it's sparked so much international outrage. We've been talking to some doctors to get their response. We spoke firstly to a British doctor, Dr. Annabel Shuemimo. She's a community reproductive health doctor in Leicester.
She didn't even really have a chance to opt out of her dad being there. So I think we also have to discuss sometimes how doctors and medical professionals can be complicit sometimes in maintaining these patriarchal processes.
We also spoke to the American obstetrician, gynecologist and New York Times contributor, Dr. Jen Gunter. This is what she had to say.
There are sort of extreme sort of religious overtones in many parts of the world, and America is certainly not excluded from that. This idea that a physician would allow father in the room for an exam with any child, I mean, any young woman about a sexual part of her body, I mean, you are owed privacy and your physician should be helping you with that.
And Farhana, it may surprise many of our listeners that a U.S. rapper is promoting these types of examinations. We often associate these examinations with other countries.
Yes, we do. And rightly so, because these examinations have been condemned, as we said earlier, by the World Health Organization. They take place, unfortunately, quite frequently in countries like Afghanistan and Egypt, countries with poor human rights records and, in particular, a lack of female autonomy. Having said that, the daughter, Deyar Harris, has been quite silent, hasn't spoken publicly about the outrage after her father's comments. But she has been responding on Twitter and liking comments that have said that her father's behaviour is possessive, disgusting, controlling. In fact, on that note of it being very controlling and possessive, further in that podcast, the rapper T.I., when he's referring to telling the doctor what he wants done, he in fact tells the doctor, and I'm now going to quote him, "Just check the hymen, please, and give me back my results expeditiously."
Farhana Dawood. Next to the gold sparkly dress that's lighting up Twitter, a photo of it was posted by Rita King, a scientist in the United States. She tweeted, "Cleaning out my closet, I came across this gown and remembered the little girls who sent me a letter and asked me to wear something sparkly for a talk I gave at NASA so they could believe that scientists could also be sparkly." Divya Arya has been speaking to Rita.
I was giving a talk and one of the event coordinators had been given a note from a group of girls who were planning to attend. The whole audience was made up of young people. And they wanted to feel like a scientist could be sparkly, and they wanted to see a sparkling geek on stage. And so she told me this, and I think it's important to know your audience and to deliver a message in a way that your audience wants to hear it. So I thought, let me do that. And I bought the dress specifically for that event. I've never worn it since. And the reason I picked that dress is because it was NASA and the cosmos is sparkly and it sort of had a cosmic sheen to it.
And what do you generally wear?
When I'm working with clients, I often joke with my friends that I dress in the severe style of the Spanish imperialists in Naples during the Italian Renaissance. I wear all black, black flats, black slacks, black blazer, black shirt. A lot of the work that I do is with senior leadership teams. And in that sort of a context, I will often wear some variation of the same outfit day after day for weeks on end. However, when I give talks, I will dress for the audience. On other occasions, I have, you know, bodysuits that are printed with NASA pictures of the cosmos. It really depends on the audience and the way an audience needs to hear a message. And in this case, the message was serious. The talk was called "The Future Needs Your Imagination." And it was a message to kids that every single person on Earth is born with an imagination, no matter where you're born, no matter in what circumstances, and that the systems in which these kids are growing up are broken, and they're going to need to reinvent them in order to have a functional adulthood within them.
There's also some gendering in the way we dress and the way it is perceived. So the whole idea of looking feminine despite being a scientist probably played a part in that decision of yours.
Yes, I think, you know, a term that I hear a lot is imposter syndrome, when a person feels that they don't conform to the dominant standard that we're supposed to, quote unquote, conform to. And of course, that is often a masculine standard of power and authority that we are accustomed to seeing, which puts anyone who doesn't conform to that standard in a position of making a decision to either try to conform to something that is not natural to them or part of their identity, or be themselves, which is a more complex issue. The template for authority and power has always been masculine, but the universe itself is sparkly. And so to think that sparkles are frivolous in any way diminishes what I would consider to be a higher authority than our earthly perceptions of what makes a person authoritative or powerful. And I think we need to rethink how we perceive, how we react in the face of a template of power and authority.
The sparkly scientist, Rita King. Still to come in this podcast. how camels are helping communities in Kenya plug a gap in healthcare. In South Sudan, rival leaders have failed to form a unity government, missing next week's United Nations deadline to do so. The move was central to a peace agreement the two factions signed last year. The extension won't go down well internationally, and missing it means there could be sanctions from South Sudan's largest donor, the United States. For more on this delay, I spoke to our correspondent Patience Atuhede, who's in Kampala in Uganda, where the talks were being held.
There are the two big major tribes, the Nuer and the Dinka. Salva Kiir is Dinka, Riek Machar is Nuer. Now, the war broke out in November 2013 between rival fighting forces allied to the two big men. And that hasn't been sorted out to this day. But there are still those issues that they can't seem to sort out, including how do you form a unified army in a country like South Sudan with so many rival groups, so many different sentiments? And I think that's why the peace deal, it still hasn't been implemented. This was the second time the deadline for forming of a unity government was being extended. So I think that's because there are still those political issues, including issues like the drawing of the state boundaries, which states should they have, how many should they have. That's why it keeps shifting and shifting.
And what difference will an extra 3 months make, if any?
For a long time, Riek Machar has lived outside of South Sudan. And for a long time, he didn't even travel there. So since early this year, and since this process started, he's traveled back to South Sudan. He's traveled to Uganda today to this meeting. He had asked for 6 months for issues of contention like the army and the state boundaries to be ironed out. There's hope that things are looking forward because he's willing to sit at the table. I think the extra 3 months may get things smoothened out as long as the SPLA in opposition are willing to, I guess, make some concessions as well.
This crisis began not long after South Sudan itself was created as a nation. So is there still hope that a functioning South Sudan can actually exist?
Since the signing of the revitalized peace deal in September 2018, there hasn't been much fighting in most of the country. There are still some sporadic clashes here and there, but largely the guns have gone silent. So that sort of points to the fact that there is hope. This could work. Of course, the most important people at the center of all this are ordinary South Sudanese. So for them, they are tired. South Sudanese have lived through war, most of them all their lives. And so they are thinking this needs to end.
Patience Atuhede. The former French leader Napoleon's favorite general has been formally identified after DNA tests on a one-legged skeleton found under a dance floor in Western Russia. Analysis confirmed that the bones belonged to Charles-Étienne Goudin, according to French archaeologists. He died in the French invasion of Russia in 1812. Ali McConnell has the details.
General Goudin commanded the final charge of French forces at the Battle of Valutina in August 1812. The French made some progress, but the general was unlucky. His leg was struck by a cannonball and amputated. He succumbed to gangrene and died 3 days later. Only his heart was returned to France. The rest of his remains had long been thought lost. But in May, his one-legged skeleton was finally located under a dance floor in a park in the city of Smolensk. The historian who led the search for the general's body said the DNA exactly matched that of his brother, Pierre César Goudin, who was also a Napoleonic general.
Nomadic groups in Kenya cross huge areas of countryside in search of water and pasture for their livestock. The nearest hospitals and clinics are many kilometers away, and the nomads are often unable to access the health services they need. But as Christine Njeri reports, mobile camel clinics are bringing medical help to these communities.
I've traveled hundreds of kilometers and many hours to get here from Nairobi to meet members of the nomadic Samburu community who live in soaring temperatures that can reach up to 40 degrees Celsius. And I've come here with a unique convoy. The Samburu community are often known for their nomadic lifestyle, moving from one place to the other. For them, the Camel Mobile Clinic has brought hope to their community. As you can hear, they are singing and chanting because of the joy of the mobile clinic bringing medicine to their manyatas. We think of mobile clinics as temporary medical centers that can be driven to places in need. What we don't think of is this. The people in this desert region depend on camels to bring them medical supplies. A doctor begins the clinic inside one of the tents that has been set up under the shade.
The importance of using camels is that we extend the services whereby the vehicles, they cannot reach. For the mobile clinic, we don't have any charges. It's just free of charge. When we reach to our village, we offload the camels. Then we make our tents, we mobilize the community, and then we give health talks. And then from there, we start the services. The last mobile clinic happens 1 year ago.
People line up eagerly for consultation. Some have walked here from settlements over 50 kilometers away. Families in Samburu often wait for long periods for the next clinic to be scheduled, sometimes up to 6 months or even a year. Naisula has brought her four-year-old child here.
When the camels pass by, they bring medicines and injections.
The community here faces many challenges. And without the necessary infrastructure, the mobile clinic and its camels provide vital health care. A health, nutrition and hygiene training session is happening with mothers with children seated under the one tree casting shade. The community nurse, Apollen Amonyi, says the mobile service tries to offer holistic care.
Most of the health facilities are far away from the communities. That is why we bridge the gap using the camel outreaches. The essence is to reach children, and that is why we are encouraging these mobile outreaches. We integrate all services, and also we can reach the lactating mothers, antenatal mothers, and we are also encouraging, if we can get deliveries during the outreaches, we also encourage skilled birth attendants.
As the sun begins to set in the late afternoon around 4 p.m., the families start the long walk home, mothers carrying children on their backs. For them, it's worth the trip.
Christine and Jerry with that report. Finally, join me, dear listeners, as we cast our minds back in time, several thousands of years, in fact, as archaeologists in Mexico have announced that they have found at least 14 mammoth skeletons in what they say is the first man-made mammoth trap discovered anywhere in the world. Yes, it's big. Professor Silvia Gonzalez is a geoarchaeologist from Liverpool's John Moores University. She's Mexican herself and is one of the go-to people when it comes to research on mammoths. She gave Razia Iqbal her assessment of the latest discovery.
A series of pits, man-made pits, were found where there is a very large amount of mammoth bones. And the conclusion is that these were man-made and that the humans were hunting mammoths. And what is staggering is there is quite a lot of mammoths that are found sometimes around the lake shore, but never with this enormous pit. We are talking of pits that are about 25 meters long, 1.7 meters depth. The sheer amount is telling us that they were thinking about the hunting, and we never had anything like this before. And this is a very important find, not just for Mexico, but for the whole world, because never before anything like this has been found.
So essentially, the discovery of pits and the bones in the pits tells you that these were traps for the mammoths.
That's correct. And there is also evidence of butchering. So there are cut marks on the bones. This is just the beginning of this research. I'm sure that a lot more very interesting facts are going to appear. And this is something completely new. It's in fact a watershed in the studies for these animals for the whole of the American continent.
And what does that tell us then about the people who might have been doing this?
is telling us that they were organized, that they were thinking ahead, that they were probably herding the animals to fall into these traps. Apart from the mammals, there is evidence of one horse and one camel. And it's just the level of sophistication that they needed to have to organize all of these strategies for hunting. This means that there were communities that were dedicated to do these activities, in that a lot of planning and organization, and probably, you know, somebody directing all of these. Never like this, anything like this happened before. We need to remember that at the time, the environment in Mexico was very different. We had a lot of grasslands around, because we know that these animals, being so large, need a very large amount of grass to be eaten to be able to subsist. And in fact, they go extinct about 10,000 years ago, because we know that there are very strong changes in the environment. There is a series of very strong volcanic eruptions. And of course, all the hunting of these animals that finally leads to the extinction of these species in the Valley of Mexico.
Professor Silvia Gonzalez. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.